You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
There's nothing like hearing the results of research directly from those who actually conducted it. It is these women and men who are transforming HIV treatment and care. At CROI 2008, one of the most important HIV-related medical conferences of the year, Dr. Gerald Perrone interviewed a number of researchers about their studies. What follows is one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Jerry Perrone from the AIDS Research and Treatment Center of the Treasure Coast at the retrovirus meeting, and I'm here with Brian Porter.
Hi, I'm Brian Porter. I'm from the National Institutes of Health. I work with a group at the NIH that's been studying IL-2 for really about two decades now. It seems like the people in the IL-2 field are really dedicated to it and have been with it for a long time. And you probably know that IL-2 has been looked at for a lot of different indications in HIV. We're all familiar with the concerns about treatment interruption that many large studies have shown us, SMART, Staccato, et cetera, that there are problems with that. So one question that we had was that could IL-2 serve as a heart-sparing therapy? In other words, during periods of treatment interruption, if those subjects received IL-2 as needed based on CD4 count, could they maintain their CD4 counts at the end of a six-month period compared to baseline? So essentially what we did is we looked at a group of 41 patients who had all received IL-2 in the past as part of previous therapy. We gave them a baseline IL-2 cycle while they were relatively immunocompetent with good T-cell counts around 950, for the most part suppressed viral loads less than 50. And from that point on, we randomized them to either stop their heart or to continue heart for 6 months. Now, any of those subjects could get additional IL-2 cycles, again, as needed for CD4 counts falling below a threshold of 500 cells per microliter. And at the end of that six-month period, we asked ourselves, did those patients maintain their CD4 counts, and were they considered treatment successes because they had CD4 counts that were at least 90% of what their baseline counts were?
Before you go into the results, do you know why the decision was made to include people that had previously received IL-2?
Right. That's a great question. A lot of that was because, again, these subjects were drawn from other IL-2 studies that had already been ongoing at the NIH, and so most of these patients had participated actively in NIH protocols using IL-2 as a supplement to their heart therapy already. So on average, the two groups were randomized, and on average, the subjects had had a median of about 9 IL-2 cycles, actually, but with a relatively wide range. Some had as few as 4, others had as many as 26, actually, was, I think, our highest. So our criteria was that we wanted them at least to all have 3 cycles of IL-2 as sort of a way of normalizing that. We actually did bring in some people from outside of the NIH cohort if we could establish that they had received IL-2 already previously. So the best way to summarize the question or the answer to the question would be that we were also looking for the impact of IL-2 with continuous heart in a relatively immunocompetent subject, an immunocompetent person, and giving that sort of immune boosting with the IL-2, could that then protect you during treatment interruption?
Okay, and what did you find?
Well, the primary endpoint really showed that the IL-2 supplementation could not be considered to be non-inferior to just continuing heart. In other words, kind of that circular is a way of talking, but what it amounts to is they couldn't maintain their CD4 cell counts at 6 months compared to baseline at the same level as those patients who simply continued heart. So what you can see from table 2 is that with the treatment interruption group, actually 8 of the subjects needed to get an additional IL-2 cycle because their T cell counts were waning while they were undergoing treatment interruption, compared to the continuous group, none of whom needed any IL-2 while they were still continuing heart. So that was one difference there. And you can see a treatment success rate of just under 50% for the interruption group, and almost 100%, 92%, basically everyone except for one subject in the continuous group.
And can you tell me, how was treatment success defined in this study?
So again, treatment success on an individual basis is having a month 6 CD4 cell count of at least 90% of what your baseline count was. So we did allow people to fall a little bit, within 10%, but we didn't want their T-cell counts to fall below 10%. And remember that these were, I'll say, relatively healthy patients. I mean, that's the best way to characterize them.
It sounds like that's a fairly stringent threshold for defining treatment failure, 10%. For people starting with CD4 counts almost 1,000.
But again, I think if you're putting into the context of treatment interruption, we want to make sure that our interruptions are not in any way harming our patients, right? So that's why we're going to call them a success if they can maintain their counts of at least 90%. And remember that we're starting at baseline with relatively high counts. The two groups are randomized, and they both started with medians of about 950 T cells at baseline. So again, you know, they had high T cell counts and suppressed viral loads for the most part at baseline. And when you look at the actual changes over time, the treatment interruption group fell by about 90 cells per microliter in terms of the delta, the change, whereas the continuous group who continued on their heart actually went up even further by 400 cells at month six. And again, that's probably due to that initial baseline IL-2 cycle that they had at the start of study. So that was really the primary endpoint, but I tell you, there are a couple very interesting, I think, secondary endpoints in the study as well. One is that at the end of the six-month period, not only could the treatment interruption group continue to interrupt for another 6 months, so basically had a one-year interruption, which all of the 27 in that group decided to do, but the continuous heart group had the option of crossing over into treatment interruption. So basically now we could compare what the difference is between early treatment interrupters who interrupted at the start of study after that first baseline cycle versus late treatment interrupters who basically had, after the baseline cycle, 6 months of heart and then interrupted. And what was interesting about that is, treatment success-wise, no difference. Those late interrupters also only had about a 50% treatment success rate. What did differ is that their CD4 count seemed to decline at an even more rapid rate. This is what figure 3 is showing, the slopes of CD4 count changes between the two groups. The late treatment interrupters, after stopping heart, seemed to decline even faster than the early treatment interrupters. And ultimately, you know, having the same level of treatment success or failure, about 50%.
But to put this into perspective, someone in your study could be defined as a treatment failure if their CD4 count, starting from a level of 1,000, went down to 900. Is that
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is exactly right. Because we were looking for no more than a 10% decline.
I think in clinical practice, many times, patients with very high CD4 counts will vary from month to month by over 100 CD4 cells. So I think out in clinical practice, that would not be considered a clinical failure. It would be considered more of natural variation in CD4 levels from time to time.
That's really a good point. I couldn't tell you right now sort of the standard deviation, you know, offhand in terms of the month-to-month variability. Definitely, though, you could look at the two groups as a whole and look at their median counts and really see a trend. You know, you could definitely see a trend, for instance, there. But yeah, I think that is a good point, that there definitely is month-to-month variation. Again, I think the reason for having somewhat of a strict criteria is because we knew that we were doing an intervention. You know,
sure.
It was treatment interruption, so you want to make sure you're adhering to that do no harm.
And also, the group on continuous heart received, in effect, an IL-2 boost right at the initiation of
that's
study.
That's right.
So
that's correct.
They were given even more of a...
Yes,
of a,
yes,
of
that's
a,
exactly right.
Of a buffer,
yeah.
Perhaps.
And, you know, one other point just to say, I mean, we all know the concerns about treatment interruption, like we were mentioning, but the one that we really tried to address in this study was whether or not that interruption period would give you a benefit for metabolic indices. So even though it's not reflected as much in the data presented here, we actually did a really extensive metabolic analysis of these two groups at baseline and month six, including both external and internal measures of body fat, the ones we're familiar with, limb thicknesses, skin fold thicknesses, but also internal measures, visceral and subcutaneous fat measures by CT scan, and then a whole host of biochemical parameters, liver tests, thyroid tests, lipids, etc. And out of all those parameters, about 50 different parameters, the only ones that really showed a significant difference at month six between the two groups were shown here, total cholesterol, APO, lipoprotein A1, and hemoglobin A1C. But if you notice the p-values for the first two, cholesterol and APO A1, they're less than 0.05, but if you do a Bonferroni correction for the number of comparisons we did, honestly, I'm not that impressed by those. I really think that those were just randomly found to be significant because those p-levels really are too high. A good threshold p-level would be 0.0005 or less, which hemoglobin A1C actually did achieve. But then again, is there any clinical relevance to those absolute values?
So just to clarify, so you saw that the hemoglobin A1Cs in patients with treatment interruption were
slightly higher and at a significant level than the continuous group. But again, I'm not so concerned about the clinical impact of that because we're talking 5.4% versus roughly 5% in continuous. And, you know, good hemoglobin A1C is below 6%.
Okay, I understand. So
yeah.
So statistically significant.
Exactly,
not,
but
not
maybe
clinically
not clinically
meaningful.
Relevant. So actually, I think what's interesting is the fact that in a six-month treatment interruption, and these were all adequately powered at 80% using the sample size for the metabolic indices anyway, and no real impact or no significant impact, let's say, or just a minimal impact on those metabolic indices mm-hmm. between the two groups.
Any side effects from IL-2?
You know, we saw some adverse effects which are familiar with all of our IL-2 dosing studies. These are basically grade 3 events, headache, fatigue, some abdominal pain. Not in many patients, but, you know, what people have normally seen, people often will get Tylenol or ibuprofen, and they'll be able to get through those side effects. Nothing that made anyone stop their IL-2
manageable.
Cycle prematurely. Exactly.
And again, these were patients pre-selected for ability to tolerate IL-2.
Yes, exactly right. That's a great point. There was one grade 4 adverse event, a hyperbilirubinemia, but we think that this was consistent with this patient having pre-existent Gilbert syndrome. patients are having problems with processing unconjugated bilirubin. And I will point out that there were four clinical events that were significant in the study, an acute retroviral syndrome, syphilis, Kaposi's, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And these were all in patients who underwent treatment interruption, either during the study itself as part of the protocol or after they completed the study during their enrollment in the study and decided to treatment interrupt. We still followed the patients out sort of to see could our study have impacted them in the future. And we did see that there were four significant clinical events, but there didn't seem to be any relationship in terms of which group they were from.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so going forward, take-home message for clinicians, IL-2 in this context, not useful.
And I think by saying in this context, it's actually really important because with this particular context, it couldn't maintain your T-cell counts during treatment interruption. But, you know, ongoing now are studies that are looking at IL-2 being used before indications for clinical indications for heart in more immunocompetent individuals, even using it in early HIV infection, things like this. So I don't know if we can make the blanket statement to say that it could never be a heart-sparing therapy. But in this context, I feel that we have pretty convincing data that it wasn't able to do that.
Yes. And I think to that point, there's another poster at this meeting using IL-2 perhaps to delay initiation of heart.
Exactly. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, very good. Thank you
very much. Thank you so much. Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.